Welcome to episode 2 of the Smart ADHD podcast. I'm Ian Addison-Gray, and this is the first Smart ADHD Stories episode. And I was honoured to be joined by the amazing Kerry Jordan. Now, since you're listening or watching to episode 2, I'm going to assume you're pretty new to the Smart ADHD podcast. And so I wanted to kind of let you know the plan or what the plan is. Most episodes in this podcast are going to be short 20 to 25 minute episodes, and I'll be joined by an ADHD expert in those. And as I keep on saying, I am no ADHD expert, but I'll be joined by experts to help bust myths, help us understand how ADHD works, and to give us smart strategies on how to counteract our ADHD traits. Sometimes I'll be sharing what I've learned along the way too. But interspersed between these shorter episodes, my plan is to invite smart creatives, entrepreneurs, or business owners who have been navigating their lives with ADHD and allow them to tell their stories. They'll be sharing how ADHD has shaped and affected their lives, with its challenges and excitements, and the ups and the downs. These are real conversations, real stories from smart ADHDers. We won't be sugarcoating, but we'll be looking to the future where there's always hope. And we'll be sharing smart strategies along the way. These episodes will be much longer because we just need time to get real and allow us to tell those stories. This episode is the first Smart ADHD Story episode, and I had such an amazing time speaking with Kerry. I think this is actually the second time we've spoken to each other, but it already feels like we've known each other for years. She was so gracious and honest, and I hope you get as much from this conversation as I did. I've not edited this really at all. There's a few little tiny little edits, but on the whole, what I'm trying to do with these episodes is to keep them really raw and real. And so if you can ignore any of the ums and the ahs and stumblings over words, that's kind of sometimes the way our brains work. Now, remember, we're not experts. And so if you've been affected by anything that we talk about in this episode, don't cope alone. It's always best to contact a medical professional where you are and seek professional help. But we would love to hear from you. So do get in touch by sending me an email to ian@smartadhd.me. So Kerry Jordan is a professional photographer. She helps entrepreneurs engage, or I should say petrepreneurs. There you go. I love that. Petrepreneurs engage their ideal audience by creating stunning commercial photography and content. And she can be found at a website, furandfables.com. So enough of me gibbering. Let's get on with the episode right now. Hello, Kerry. Welcome to the Smart ADHD podcast. You are my first guest in this format. We've had some expert guests on, but you are my first guinea pig. So welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm quite glad that I'm the first because I've got nobody else to compare to. So I don't feel quite so bad. Apart from the excellent like professional guest that you had on, who does sound very smart.
Well, yeah. Tamara has been amazing. And she's been... Because I had a bit of imposter syndrome. And then I realized I don't need to be an expert. You know, we can share our journey. And that's what this episode is about. These are telling the story, stories of smart ADHD creators, business owners, entrepreneurs. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I think I do struggle with the word smart because I do question my own intelligence. But we can maybe get into that because I'm sure that affects a lot. I've spoken to a lot of people, very smart people with ADHD, and they're all the same. So tell us a little bit about, before we get stuck in, tell us who you are, what it is you do business-wise, and whereabouts you are located.
Okay, my name's Kerry Jordan. I'm 46, I think. I might have to go back and check that. I am a commercial pet photographer, which basically means I'm a visual storyteller for pet brands, currently in the UK, but hoping for worldwide domination. And I live in West Cumbria. So if anybody doesn't know that, it's like I'm 10 minutes from the edge of the Lake District, which is absolutely beautiful. and I moved here 3 years ago from West Sussex. So a fair bit of distance and a fair bit of temperature change.
Well, it's a beautiful part of the world. It really is. So let's go back to the beginning, I suppose. And before we get back to the beginning, I want to ask you the question. When did you first realize you had ADHD?
Well, I guess I've always felt that I was different. I've always felt like I wasn't like everybody else. But it was only last year that I found out that I could possibly have ADHD. Like, I've been doing a lot of research about different mental states because I was trying to figure out why I felt so differently all the time. And I'd looked into ADHD, but this was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And the lists that were coming up were very typical of a male ADHD, and particularly sort of the younger generation. So it was hyperactivity, and like there was a list of things that I just wasn't, that I was like, but this isn't me. So I disregarded it. And then of all places, I was looking at a TikTok and I saw a video of a woman talking about her, and it was a very humorous way, talking about her ADHD challenge. But I didn't realize that's what it was at the time. I just saw the video and I was like, oh, that's me. She's just described me. So I went through and I flicked through some more, and I just started crying because it was the first time that somebody had described what I was going through, and it just felt like such a relief. And so I think that was pretty much a year ago around now. And so I looked into what I could do and heard about the sort of the diagnosis process, and in typical style went into what I now know is hyperfocus. And I basically made a diary of everything that affects me on a day-to-day basis, which could come under the ADHD banner, and took it to my doctors. And she was like, okay, well, I'm not an expert, but it does seem that this is the way. And she referred me by the Right to Choose. So instead of going by the NHS route, you get diagnosed via a private practice under the NHS banner. And so last October, November, I can't remember which one, but my diagnosis came through as confined type ADHD. And it was mind blowing. I felt such a sense of relief that I wasn't this complete, well, I am a little bit of a complete weirdo, but at least I had my tribe. But the thoughts that I were having weren't like completely off the scale. It was like there were other people like this out there.
Yeah, it's a huge relief for so many people. And I can very much identify and empathize with what you're saying. And I just want to say also, because we have listeners all around the world, so the way that you will go down the diagnosis and assessment route will be different. You know, and we're talking about here in the UK that there's this fantastic thing called Right to Choose. But the first thing to do is to speak to a medical professional in your country. We're not experts. And so, you know, if you're struggling, that's something I should have said at the beginning, but just to say, that sounds like you've had a real, I can't believe that's like a year ago. Cause and yeah, you've obviously hyper-focused, you got into the, you wrote everything down and you listed it all. That's something that I did. And I think that is such a helpful thing to do, because did you feel, as in part of that process, did you feel an element of, I don't know whether it's imposter syndrome, but there's, for me, so I had this kind of worry, well, maybe it isn't ADHD, maybe I am a lost cause and it's something else. And I was a little bit worried. And when the ADHD diagnosis came back, and it was combined type with me, it was a big relief in many respects. But was there an element of concern and worry with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I don't know if this is an ADHD thing, but, you know, I'd carry on reading some of the symptoms and I'd be like, well, that's not me. So does that mean I don't have ADHD, or I don't have it to that extent? So does that mean it's not ADHD? And I think listing it down for me, because the list was extensive, was a way of almost saying, you know, you're not being paranoid. This is something that, and I think a lot of people with ADHD will come across people who go, well, everybody's got a bit of ADHD. Everybody goes through that. Everybody does that occasionally. And it's the fact that what I realized is that it's not occasional. These are things that happen on a day-to-day basis. And they, for me personally, they affected me quite negatively, quite a lot. And I struggled. So I think making that list really helped me overcome that kind of, and it's almost like a sense of, like, I don't want to be that person who's, you know, a drama queen. It's like, I don't want to be a drama queen. You know, it's like, have I really got ADHD? And having that list in front of me almost gave me validation. It was like, no, this is quite an extensive list of the things that I have to struggle with. So, yeah, there was an element of imposter syndrome type thing.
Yeah, and I wonder whether this affects people from different generations in different ways. I mean, we're similar age, Generation X, I assume you are as well, similar kind of, or whatever. Whatever it is, you know. I mean, not that we're trying to put people into boxes, but I think we probably grew up with ADHD being seen as this like naughty boy's disease, and you know, certainly the whole, you know, being diagnosed with combined type, you think, well, where's the hyperactivity? It's not all, but then it's the realization that it's not always physical as well. And then the other thing you mentioned, you know, this is the thing that a lot of people say to us, and often it's that negative voice in our heads. It's not necessarily what other people say. It's our voice in our head say, well, like, well, surely everyone has ADHD then, you know? And I remember watching a video, a favorite YouTuber who talks about ADHD is Rick Green. He's a great guy. And he says, well, in a sense, that's right. Everyone has a little bit of ADHD, but everyone has height. You know, it's like, it is a scale. And so with ADHD, the thing is, like, yes, maybe everyone procrastinates, but like the level of procrastination that someone with ADHD has, or so if you're forgetting your keys, like how often do you forget your keys? Is it like once a week, or is it like three times a day? And so we can dig into some of that in our conversation today. But let's kind of turn back the clock. So that was a year ago that you realized, and you got this official diagnosis. But and you mentioned that you've always thought you were different. I speak to so many people with ADHD who feel that. I felt that. I thought, I don't know. I don't know what I thought about myself. Let's go back to when you were younger. When do you think, looking back, that ADHD first became a part of your story?
Well, as long as I can remember, I felt like a little bit of an outcast. So I suffered trauma quite young, so I don't know if that didn't help, obviously, but I wasn't popular at school. I was the girl who's, you know, stood in the corner. I read a lot, you know, that was my outlet. So I'd be sat in the library when people were out like playing games and things like that. I never felt, and it's weird because it's not like I feel like I'm an unconfident person, but I found talking to people difficult. My mum said that I was always somebody who talks to adults much better than I did to people my age. So even at like sort of knee height to a grasshopper, I was, you know, chatting away to my elders. But when it came to people my age, when I was at junior school and secondary school, I really struggled. And weirdly, I got on with guys much better because I found them much simpler to talk to. And I think maybe that's because my brain was so active that when I was around like my fellow girlfriends, I was always questioning, you know, the motives around. And because as a teenage girl, there's so much drama and I just couldn't handle it. So some of my closest friends were boys, you know, and it was just like we'd play on computer games and we'd go climbing trees and things. So I think it was there was always a difference there. But I think there were things like I was disruptive. I challenged authority quite often. And I think I, even though I had high expectations of being head girl, I had far too many detentions for that. So there was always that element of, I think, just a restlessness almost. It was, I got bored very easily and things like that. So I do remember, getting detention a lot. Skipping school, but still wanting to have good grades, but struggling with the grades, and my teacher saying that I was bright, but I couldn't study. So all those things now with hindsight, I'm like, okay, this is all making sense now. And then as I got older, not being able to keep a job, I was never fired. I left. I got bored. And I had real problems with money. So I got into quite a lot of debt doing payday checks. And because I didn't have an authority figure around often, those were the things that they could have gone a lot worse. I could have been in a way, way worse situation than I was, considering the impulse control that I had. So those things now, I look back, and I try not to beat myself up about, because at the time I was like, why am I like this? You know, why do I have to do this? So it was always there.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I think when we look back at our lives, there is that temptation sometimes to give into that kind of maybe regret, you know, the what if question. And I think that's quite common for people who are diagnosed later on, you know, in their 40s, 50s and beyond. That's not what we're trying to do here. We're trying to look back into the past and kind of try to understand why things maybe were a struggle. And there's a lot of things that you were saying there that were so interesting. The fact that you tended to get on better with boys and I tended to get on better with girls, actually, which is really interesting. And I don't really understand. I think so. You talked about emotions in there, and one of the big things with ADHD people is emotional dysregulation. And I think I just felt that I could be a bit more myself with girls, which seems a bit weird, but I just felt I could be, I didn't have to pretend, which was a lot simpler. So I'm just interested, you know, for you, like what was going on at school? You had, you know, you were with your friendships and the way you were interacting with people. And also you mentioned that your teachers said you were smart, but you were also getting detentions as well. And I'm laughing because, yeah, it's a similar story with me. But I remember when I got a detention, I was absolutely distraught. I was so upset that I got my first detention. And so what was going on in your head in those early years?
It was, it's bizarre because the thing with the boys was, you know, very, very similar. It was, I felt much more myself around like my male friends than I did my female friends. And I think with the female friends, it's something that becomes much more prevalent as you get older. You start masking. So it's like you start to try and emulate people. So with my female friends, I was trying to be like them, but I wasn't. So I wasn't a girly girl. You know, when I first tried makeup, I was like, oh my God, they look weird. And, you know, I didn't want to go, you know, clothes shopping. I was the one that was climbing the trees, riding my bike around the block and things like that. So when I was around the females, it was more like I felt like I had to be somebody else. And the school thing, I loved learning. And so I was and still am a nerd. You know, I love learning things. But it had to be things that like captured my attention. And I think when I, for example, physics, hated physics, loved biology. So in physics, when you're not engaged in something and then your grades fail, then you start to think, well, I'm obviously not smart, even though it's, you know, different in other areas. And you start to get that message quite young. So it was those kind of things and the emotion wise, I think the emotional dysregulation came after puberty. So I don't think I was too bad back then. But yeah, as soon as I hit my teenage years, I didn't know what to do with myself. And I was diagnosed with depression at 15 and put on Prozac at 16. So that kind of tells you how emotionally disrupted I felt inside. And of course, I was misdiagnosed because it wasn't depression, so it didn't do anything. So again, it made you feel kind of strange and, you know, why am I like this kind of thing? So yeah, the emotion side, I think it was fairly stable until I hit my teenage years.
Yeah, now that's, I hear that so often, that women and girls in particular do get misdiagnosed with depression, and it can be anxiety as well. Although those depression and anxiety can be part of that experience with ADHD. I definitely really struggled with depression at school, but I think if it had been diagnosed as depression, I don't think that would have been the right way to treat it. And so I'd be interested for you, how did that depression, was it depression, or how do you look at it now, that depression through the ADHD lens that you now know? How did it kind of manifest itself? Because I speak to quite a few people about this, you know, and everyone experiences a different level and different way of depression. Mm-hmm.
So I can't remember a huge amount about back then, but what I do know now through the research that I've done looking into it is that my depression, which is still something that happens now, isn't just depression. It's caused by the ADHD and the way that my ADHD manifests. So it could be that was similar when I was growing up, where I didn't know how to control my emotions. And so I would start having emotional outbursts, which I knew weren't sort of societally correct. So I would start like keeping them in, which is the worst thing that you could possibly do. But I was a teenager, I didn't understand. Now I realize, because I've got this inner dialogue, which it can be really debilitating sometimes, that's what causes my depression, because I will start this conversation, I will start this scenario in my head, and it's never positive, which is a real bummer. Yeah. It's never, I'm going to win this amazing award. It's more like, this person said this, so this means this, and what happens if this happens? And then I start to go downwards, and then that's when the depression hits. So from what I've read and people I've spoken to, sometimes the way that the ADHD manifests, that can lead then to the depression. So it's not a constant, but it is there.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And it's that... it is that inner dialogue. I mean, you probably, everyone has an inner dialogue. And I've
apparently not.
Well, but not to the extent, I would say, as people with ADHD. And it's kind of constantly there. That's the thing. That's really interesting. And so you said that you kind of suppressed that, I think. Why do you think you did that? Why did you kind of like... because again, I think that's a common thing. I did the same thing. I suppressed the emotions. Is that kind of like what's the word I'm looking for? Like a safety thing. You're kind of trying to protect yourself.
I think, and I don't know if this is. I've only just thought of this, but maybe it's something that people with ADHD come across. Is you start to become very self-aware. Mm. So you recognize when whatever you're doing is not acceptable to other people. So, you know, emotional outbursts, you know, crying, or, you know, getting upset over very small things. You can see, and you do pick up on the reactions of other people. And I don't know if this is an ADHD thing, but then you know, you don't want to make people feel uncomfortable. So that's when you start to repress those, and you become very aware then of how you are acting around people and how you manifest your emotions around people. So that's how I started doing it. I started recognizing the fact that this wasn't, you know, something that people wanted me to do. So I started to hide it, basically.
Yeah. And I think we tend to be very intuitive people as well. So we pick up on these little minor kind of micro things that are going on. And often I think we're right, but there's that doubt. You're like, oh, maybe it's me. The problem is always me. So that's really interesting. So when you got into the later years at school, into sixth form, so this is like age 16, 17, 18, and just for international viewers who don't understand the weird naming system we have here in the UK, how were things for you? So did you become better at masking? Did you become more confident? Did things get better, get worse? You know, what how did you get on in those later years at school?
Weirdly, and I'm not sure where this came from, I definitely got more confident, or maybe it was a false confidence. I think as soon as you start masking yourself and you're starting to get accepted more as this other person, that confidence then starts to grow. It's like, I'm doing the right things. I'm becoming this person that other people want to be around. So I started to get a little bit more popular as I started to get older, which was a revelation to me because I've not been until then. And I was actually classed as homeless at the age of 15 because I was in a woman's hostel, and so I had no fixed abode. And somehow I managed to get through my GCSEs, and I was introduced to, you know, going to clubbing quite early. And the music element just was awesome because it was, again, it was a confidence boost. I loved dancing and going out. And I think, you know, going out and having a drink and things like that, which was really bad because, again, it gave me this false confidence. It wasn't me. It's like, especially when you're going out and you're having a drink, it's like, this is what gave me the confidence to talk to people. So there was a confidence gain for sure, but there were, you know, when you're suppressing, it's going to overspill. And so there was a lot of overspill. There was a lot of not tantrums, but outbursts. And that would, again, set me back because it's like, why am I like this? Why can't I keep temper? Why am I so emotional about things? So it was a little bit up and down, but my confidence definitely grew. And I think, again, from the learnings that I've done, it's a constant dopamine chaser. So it's like I pushed myself to do things. I pushed myself to, you know, ask out boys that were totally out of my league and things like that, because it was like that energy spark. But I, again, same as jobs, didn't keep a relationship very long, got bored, or I would have a negative dialogue in my head and based on absolutely no facts, would dump them based on my negative dialogue. Because it was like, they're going to do it anyway, so I might as well get in there first.
It sounds great until you start to think about the negative voice and all that kind of stuff. And I had the kind of the opposite problem. I just was so anxious about being rejected that I just couldn't ask any girls out. I think of self-esteem. So I think it can manifest itself in different ways. And that's really interesting that you were kind of using asking boys out as a kind of a dopamine injection, which is fascinating. And you mentioned kind of going out for a drink and stuff like that. What I realize is how much before being diagnosed, we tend to kind of self-medicate on these things. And I suppose like that was kind of what you were doing in a way. So you weren't getting enough dopamine. So you were finding ways to kind of inject yourself with dopamine in a way. So looking back, how much of that was involved in your early years?
Oh, a lot. And again, it's only because I've been doing a lot of research and sort of self-development recently that I've realized that it's been quite a crutch. And I actually decided to have 3 months of no alcohol, which was hard. When I was working, you know, it was I masked it again because it was a very much work hard, play hard culture. So it's like, well, everybody's doing it, so it's fine. And it's now I'm like, right, at least I know that this is something that's fairly recurrent in people with ADHD, is that they do self-medicate in some way. It's helped me make that association in my brain to help me bring that down and to dissect it and to not make me like a slave to it anymore. But yeah, definitely at work, you know, I would be the first one there, like after work, having drinks, rolling in at 2 o'clock in the morning because I was 19 and you could still get up for work the next day. and it, because everybody was doing it, it felt fine. But I think I was just doing it for a different reason. And even until literally a couple of years ago, you know, I'd be getting to 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening and I'd be like, why do I crave a glass of wine? And it's not like I was getting really, really drunk. It was just that what I realise now is that my work day was over and I didn't know what to do after that because there was no regulation. So I would have a glass of wine or two and then I'd be like, right, okay, I'll just slump on the sofa. And it, you know, it was only recently that I was like, this is the reason that I'm doing this. This is why I'm doing it, because there's nothing else. I don't know what to do with my evenings. So yeah, it's unfortunately, it's been a huge crutch, but at least I'm aware of it now. And, you know, I won't change anything, but it's always good to just be aware of the reasons that you're doing things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So it's, I think this is why for me, and it sounds like for you as well, the diagnosis has been so helpful. Not only has it taken away a lot of that guilt and that shame and it's given you knowledge, but it's also like it's helping you in the moving forwards, like with strategies and understanding things, you know, and understanding how self-medication can come into this and why it's not a good idea. And sometimes it's subtle. Like just the other day, I just came home after like a really busy day. I probably was a little bit anxious and my brain was just going round and round and round. And I just felt like having a glass of whiskey. I mean, I'm a big fan of single malt whiskey. And I thought I could, yeah, just that little glass. And then I thought about it and I thought, you know, that's not a good idea. Because like, if I wanted to have a glass of whiskey because I would just really fancy having a glass of whiskey and I like the taste of it, but I'm wanting to have this glass of whiskey to quieten down my brain and to kind of stop me feeling this way. And I thought, no, I'm not going to do it. And actually, I told my wife, I said, look, I think I probably shouldn't have a whiskey because of these reasons. And she said, no, you shouldn't. I thought, oh, okay, fair enough. Yes. So she's my accountability partner there. And so, yeah, that's really interesting. So you mentioned a few things before we get into your you've mentioned a little bit kind of going into the workplace and stuff, but you mentioned a few things when you were younger. And I don't know if you feel comfortable talking about this, but you know, you mentioned about, you went into a home and there was, it sounds like things were not straightforward in your childhood.
I think this actually leads into some of the ADHD. So not the initial part. Basically, I walked away from my mum when I was quite young because of the stress that she caused. But now I know that ADHD is hereditary. I can see a lot of the issues that she had were the reasons behind that. So I was living with my dad and he actually went to prison when I was 15. And so I went to live with my stepsister, who was only maybe early 20s. And basically, she couldn't cope with me because I was a young teenage girl with ADHD whose dad had just gone to prison. And I remember vividly, there was one day where I didn't know. Like my emotions just felt so big. And this is the thing that I've come to realize is that I feel big things. There's never like a medium scale. And I was sat in my room and I got my like pillowcase and I just started tearing my pillowcase with brute force because I was so, the emotions were so huge. I just didn't know what to do with them. And I think this is possibly where, you know, when boys with ADHD, you know, throw tantrums and stuff like that, it's a very external thing. But the thoughts in my head and the emotions, and I was like ripping this thing, and I just needed to get this stuff out. So it's understandable that my young, you know, stepsister wasn't able to cope with this. So yeah, so I was putting a woman's hostel. Actually, sorry, was it when I was at the age of 16? So as soon as I turned 16, but I was the oldest in my year. So I was in a woman's hostel, so classed as homeless because there's no fixed abode. And yeah, that's where I ended up for a little while before the council got me a flat. And I think this is another thing. I didn't have any, you know, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse that I didn't have any strong adult characters around. I think maybe if I did, I would have even repressed even more, but I started to try and figure out who I was as a person quite young. So yeah, it was having a sibling who couldn't cope with you is kind of classic, I guess.
The whole emotional dysregulation thing, I think a lot of us can look into a childhood and family situations and see a lot of that, and there's definitely genetics involved, and obviously that would have had like a big impact on you. You know, those emotions that you had when you were tearing up that pillow, and did those emotions? So when you went into this hostel, and then when you got your flat, what happened to those emotions? Did as you kind of came to understand who you were, which is, that's amazing that you were able to do that so young, because for so many of us, it takes time. I still don't exactly know what I want to do when I grow up. I always joke about that and who I am. We're all trying to work that out. But yeah, how did those emotions, did they kind of die down? Because with neurotypical people, apparently, this is what's supposed to happen, you know. You go through puberty and then you become a normal person and everything's great. I mean, I'm exaggerating, of course, but that's the kind of the feeling.
I hadn't really thought about it, but when you mentioned it, I realised I think I became a bit of a loner. And so I had friends, but they were few. So I wasn't, again, very popular. You know, I didn't have like a massive group of friends. And as horrible as it sounds, I think being on my own helped because I didn't have to worry about what other people around me were thinking and doing. So I didn't have this constant stress that I was upsetting somebody or I'd said the wrong thing. And I think that helped. It's as soon as I started to get around people that I started to struggle with the emotional side again, because of this constant dialogue and the scenarios that I created in my head around a possible perceived rejection, that kind of thing. So I think it did die down because I just kept myself to myself for a little bit. Again, it's not like I didn't have friends, but the ones that I did have knew me enough to not be offended by anything weird that I said. Or
And do you look back now and think, you know, those friends, do you think some of those friends were neurodiverse themselves? Were they ADHD? I hear, you know, a lot of the time that people with ADHD tend to navigate or, you know, be attracted to people with ADHD, probably because we kind of get each other a lot more, even if we don't know we have ADHD. I've looked back and I'm pretty sure that's why I got on with the friends I got on with.
Yeah, I can't remember back then, but now definitely it's having a conversation with somebody who doesn't mind that the conversation doesn't seem to have a beginning, middle and an end. And interestingly enough, now that I've started talking about it since the diagnosis, one of my friends has been diagnosed. She was diagnosed with anxiety. She's now been diagnosed with ADHD. Another friend who suffers quite badly with rejection sensitivity. We talked about it. she's now thinking of going for diagnosis. Another friend who it doesn't affect her badly, but the traits are very, very strong, is now thinking, maybe I do have, I just thought all this stuff that I did was normal, but apparently it's not. So yes, I've now discovered that it's the people who aren't neurotypical that I struggle with sometimes, because I start picking up on these little micro expressions when I'm going off on a tangent and I'm like, oh God, I'm doing it again.
Yeah.
Whereas the people who seem to be, even if they're not diagnosed, neurodiverse, just accept it.
Yeah, because that's kind of the way their brains work as well. But yeah, that intuition that a lot of us have is a blessing and a curse, isn't it? Because it's a good thing, but it sometimes is like a superpower. I don't want to say ADHD is a superpower, because it's a very mixed bag. Let's be frank about it. But intuition is a superpower, but it needs to be used with a lot of care and attention. So, in school, how did school finish for you? Did it kind of go well? And what was the next? Can you talk us through, like, the end of school and then moving on to the next stage in your life? What was that like? Because for many people, that's quite a big thing, and I know you weren't living with parents. You were on your own, so you already had that. What's the word I'm looking for? You know, you were already, I don't know whether you would call it responsible, but you were kind of living on your own. But it's still quite a big thing, isn't it? Because you're in this institution of school, and then you've got this big wide world, and then the what next? So can you navigate? Tell us that what happened then.
Yeah, it's interesting you say about the responsibility. I think even when I was really young, there was an element of me being responsible. So, you know, I was responsible for my mum because sometimes she couldn't cope for herself. When my dad got picked up to take to prison, I had to be responsible for my siblings because my stepmum was just all over the place. So I had to be the one to take them all upstairs and tell them it'd all be okay. And I think I've always had this, I don't know what you would call it, this practicality around me. So I know we're probably going to talk about this later. I feel uncomfortable about calling myself smart, but I've definitely got street smart. So I am able to adapt to situations and as long as it's not an emotional situation, I am pretty good with scenarios and crisis. But after school, I didn't do well. I could have done much better because I was, you know, in my own, in a room, in a women's hostel. I had some great teachers who, you know, who would come and visit me and make sure I was doing okay. But I didn't have somebody to push me. So I came away with B, five C's and B, five C's, a D and two E's. B was in art. And I knew I could have done better, but it just didn't manifest. So I tried to put myself through college. And so I tried dramatic arts, weirdly, for a short period. And then I went on to trying, even back then, psychology. I was always fascinated with how the brain works. And law, I was thinking criminal psychology at the age of 17. I was always, as my mum said, a very grown-up youngster. But I was, you know, I was on council allowance, trying to put myself through college and get all the books, and it just wasn't working. So I got a job. And when I knew I was coming on this podcast, I was kind of trying to figure out how I managed to not get in trouble. I think I've got a very sense of self-preservation, but how I managed to get some of the jobs that I did, because I was inexperienced. I got my first job as an office junior. You know, I didn't have a CV. And then from there, I went for a job as an office manager, in a IT firm. And I got it. I was like, how do you go from an office junior job to an office manager job? And I don't know if this is where the masking helped, because I became somebody else. Like, I became this confident person. And even though the internal dialogue was like, what are you doing? I can't believe you're doing this. It's not going to, maybe it's the dopamine chasing as well again. But I tried to put myself through college, didn't work, got my first job, got my second job. But that's when the debt started to happen, when I started to, you know, I wanted to go out and I wanted to get all this stuff to buy, and I just didn't have the money. So I started cashing payday checks. With hindsight, again, what I've learned is that a lot of people with ADHD have very low impulse control, particularly when it comes to shopping and problems with money. So again, now that I'm aware of that, I've put things in place to sort of just help. But back then, it was just, yeah, I was just buying stuff. So that's kind of what came after school. And yeah, that's where I started working my way up the career ladder.
The whole finance thing. I'd be really interested for people listening and watching about the whole, the getting into debt thing. Because I think the problem is, like, credit cards are like the worst thing for some people with ADHD. It's like a little dopamine machine. I remember I think this was when like the first smartphones came, and I saw this phone and I wanted it. And I kept on saying, no, I can't afford it. But then I just went in really quickly and I bought it and I walked out, and it was just too easy. So I actually gave somebody my credit card, just please look after it for me. Because it's a tricky one. Do you look back now? Because when you mentioned like your results, there was maybe I'm misinterpreting it, but you, it seems like you're still kind of looking back at those days with a little bit of regret. And how did you? Because you're clearly, even if you're not going to say this, I'm going to say this. You are a smart person, and there is that. There is that.
I'm cringing.
I know. Look, well, I don't know if you heard. Actually, I think it was it the episode that I published. It was Tamara anyway, was talking about me being smart, and I was cringing. I think the episode isn't out. Yes, it's going to come, and you'll see maybe the look of absolute cringe on my face. But I think often, like, I look back at my results at school, and let's be frank, like, do like GCSEs and A levels? Does anyone worry about those at later on? They don't really, I shouldn't say this, but how much of a difference do they make? But at the time, I think we can look at ourselves and think, if we know in our heads, I think that we can achieve a lot more. And maybe part of us know that we are actually smart, even though the inner dialogue is saying, no, we're not. And we know that we can achieve a lot more, but because of the circumstances, because of the way our brains work, we don't achieve what we think we want, that we should be getting. Were you kind of beating yourself up a little bit about that, or was that not an issue for you?
I think at the time, obviously, I was disappointed because I have this sense that I can achieve more. And that always makes me feel quite cringy as well, because it's like, who are you to do this? But it's I've always had this inner feeling that I am capable of more, which again makes me cringe. But so I was disappointed because I knew I could do better. And it's the same as, you know, when I had high expectations of being the head girl but kept getting detention, so I couldn't. So I always had this sort of this thing to achieve. But as an adult now, I think I hate the fact that when GCSEs come round and there's so much pressure on kids, and more so now than then. So I try and post about the fact that I didn't do well, and it's not what you grades you get, it's what you do with them, because people can get straight A's and do nothing with their lives. And the only time that it's been an issue for me was when I was mid-20s and I went for a job at, I think it was the Bank of England. And they turned me down because of my grades. And even though I was way more experienced than a lot of the other people there. So that's the only time that it's been an issue. And I think if somebody with ADHD has got bad grades, the creativity element will just push them forward anyway, as long as they can harness the creativity and they have that lack of fear that a lot of us have, it doesn't really matter anymore personally. You know, I knew my circumstances were hard, so having those grades doesn't say anything about who I was as a person.
No. Absolutely not. And but it can really affect some people because of that that negative self-dialogue. You said something really interesting there that I wanted to lean into, and that's kind of what got you out of that. And I don't want to put words into your mouth, so correct me if I'm wrong here, but what got you out of that thinking was leaning into your creativity. And you are clearly a very creative person. A lot of people with ADHD are, not all, but a lot are. And so when did you realize that you were a really creative person? And tell us a little bit more about that time after college and stuff, when you started to lean into that, and how did that kind of save you? I don't know if that's the right phrase, but yeah, tell us a bit more about that.
So the creativity element has always been there for as long as I can remember. At school, I was writing children's stories. I was trying to illustrate them. I was looking into fashion design. I grew up in a fairly rough area, let's say. And so these things were not something that was instilled in school or via, you know, peers or siblings. This was just there. I loved music. My music teacher told me he was quite disappointed that I didn't take it as a GCSE. And so I think the way that personally my brain works, because it's always active, I'm always coming up with new things. And I think that stood me in good stead when I went into the corporate world. So it's not particularly creative world. However, I was always open to new ideas and I was always looking for new things to do and trying to be creative with solutions and, you know, trying to solve problems creatively. And similar to when I wasn't disruptive, but I wouldn't accept the normal way of thinking. So that, in that respect, I think it helped me in the corporate world. And again, with things like my CV, I wouldn't stand to the normal template. I try and add something interesting in there, which would make me stand out from the other people. And so, you know, and obviously I know I have ADHD, but my hobbies were, you know, on there all the time because they weren't the normal hobbies. Yeah. And archery being one of them. And so it was those kind of things that helped me just get by, really, in a very structured corporate world. It's the creative way that my brain thought that stopped me, I think, going overboard a little bit. But as I said, I don't think I stayed in one job more than 2 years. So yeah, the creativity only had so far.
Yeah, this was because you got bored, and the creativity, it could help to a point, but then you needed a new something different, a new challenge, I suppose. So can you tell us a little bit more about when you say the corporate world? I mean, that can mean lots of different things. What were the kind of jobs that you were doing? And I'm really interested to know some of these things that you were thinking. A lot of this is like the divergent thinking. I'm getting better. I always get mixed up with convergent and divergent. But I think as ADHD people, we tend to be kind of very good at thinking out of the box, thinking at other ways around. And other people can think, Oh, wow. Like, how did you think of that? And you're thinking, well, that's just the way my brain works. So tell us about you, you know, the corporate jobs that you were doing and some of the kind of, I don't know if you can remember any of these like creative ideas that you were thinking about, but maybe kind of, if you can, share some of those.
So I started off as an office manager in an IT firm in Manchester. And it was the things like I would take on board the things that other people wouldn't. So I was the office manager, but we didn't have an IT department in-house. It was down south. So I was the one taking over the patching of the telephone lines and the wiring and the patching up of all the PCs and things like that. So I think because it was just another element to keep me interested, the creativity thing came in because I was doing things that other people didn't want to do or that didn't know how to do, but I was learning. And this is, this is how I got through a lot of my corporate years is I, again, coming back to school, I was learning new things all the time and I was pushing myself. So it was not sticking to my job spec, basically. Yeah. So that's the way that the creativity element helped me because I was constantly looking at things around me and saying, can I do that? Can I do that? Can I help with that? So from there, I moved down to London and I worked on an IT help desk for a short while. And then again, onto the London Clearinghouse on an IT help desk there. And I wanted to be in the hardware section. I wanted to do the patching and the telephone lines. I got told that it was very, very physical for a woman, so I couldn't go down that route. It was a long time ago. I wouldn't have stood for that nowadays.
No.
And then I went into being a PA. And so I was being a PA to CEOs, MDs, business owners. Weirdly, loved it. I loved organising other people. Can't organise myself, loved organising other people. And one of my bosses, who's a very successful entrepreneur, when he gave me my reference, said, Kerry is like a swan. So she's cool, calm and collected on the surface. And then underneath, everything is like going 10 to the dozen, which I think describes me perfectly. Those kind of elements, yeah, they just pushed me forward in the corporate world because I wasn't sticking to my job role. I was always trying to look for other things to do. So it's not necessarily coming up with like a single creative solution. It was more like a wider scope.
Mm. Now that's fascinating. It's really interesting, isn't it? Because you'd think that like being a PA would be the last job somebody with ADHD would be doing, but this is the thing. This, you know, sometimes there are the stereotypes and actually you were really good at organizing other people and coming up with creative ways to do that. And I've had a similar experience in my life. Like I can be hyper organized, like, and this is the hyper fixation, hyper focus kind of thing. You can do things like you're a ninja with things. But when it comes to the boring stuff, we really struggle with that. So I will come back. I do want to kind of come back to the maybe this point in your life, but I'm really interested to know and it's so interesting. You did all these IT things, and then you became a PA. So what was the journey from there and to what you're doing now? Because what you're doing now is just a little bit different to all of that. So I'm just kind of interested to know some part of that journey.
There was a very specific change, and it was, and this is saying how old I am. So it was before the age of smartphones with cameras on them. I picked up just a point and shoot camera, and I bought one because we were taking photos out on nights out with our friends on those ones that you had to get printed, basically. And so I bought just a little point and shoot camera, just so that it was a bit more practical and it had a bit more functionality. And it was just friends on a night out or friends on a walk, that kind of thing. I just wanted to create these memories. And then from there, I picked up I bought my first digital SLR, and it had a very clunky zoom lens. And there was a moment, and I was in a caravan park, and there's some tulips, and I took a photo, zoomed in on this tulip, and the background was all blurry, but the tulip was in focus, and that was it. I was hooked. I was like, this is beautiful. I can't believe this is what you can do. And I just started practicing, and on everything I did, event photography for gigs. So a Guns N' Roses tribute band, I did some photography for them. I did food photography, cheese, wine, vineyards. I did like restaurants. I just, whatever I could do, I was just like absorbing all these different scenarios and all these different ways that you could photograph, which, as you can probably imagine, for an ADHD person, is a dream. But this was all sort of a hobbyist type thing. And then I got made redundant and decided to start trying to do weddings, because I thought, this was possibly about 15 years ago, that's the only way that you could make money as a photographer. You know, the internet wasn't like a massive, vast thing that it is now. So I didn't have very much information about what you could do with photography or how you could do it. So I started second shooting and shooting my own weddings and got good quick. I was finalist in a few regional awards, which, again, the imposter syndrome came in. It blew my mind a little bit. Like, don't understand. I've only been doing this a year or two. And then I got my first dog. And then that's when everything completely changed. I started taking photographs of him, set up a little page called Whippet Snippets, which gained like 9,000 followers, which in those days was huge.
Yeah.
And people started commissioning me for their own dog portraits. And so I did. And I was charging, I think, £25 for an hour's session way back then. And I got a call from a lady called Debbie, who made jumpers for dogs, like handmade jumpers, hand-knitted jumpers. And her photographer had just quit. And she'd seen my Whippet Snippets page. And she said, can we work together? I was so nervous after this phone call, and I was so desperate for the job. And she came to me, we did some photography. I looked at it the other day. Oh my days, it was awful. But she loved it, and that's the main thing. And it's just kind of steamrolled from there. I moved to Cumbria after my divorce 3 years ago and found the private client photography really hard. You know, it's a completely different area. It's very rural where I am. And I was doing more and more commercial photography organically. So brands were approaching me. And I thought, this is easy. I hated the selling element of the private client stuff. So trying to sell the wall art and things like that. I'd been on sales courses. I tried some various different methods. And it's just hard. Whereas the commercial side, I found it easy. And again, it was the organization element that I liked, you know, organizing dog models, organizing locations, organizing shot lists, the works. And last October, I just decided to go all in and have got maybe 5 or 6 new clients, regular clients since then. And that's where the transition started, like right back from picking up a point and shoot camera to nights out to full-time commercial pet photographer.
That's amazing. And it's that, looking back at your life, you know, that creativity that's been there like right since the early days, and this ability to hyper-focus and hyper-fixate, which, let's be frank, is not always a good thing, but in this case it was, because you like went probably into so much depth and details on how cameras worked and how to take photographs. The intuition, I think, that you've got is really helped, because you just probably, part of it is technical, I'm sure, but part of it is like you just know how to take a good photo. And But the way that's all worked together, and I think it's great the way you've been able to realize like what you're not comfortable with, what doesn't float your boat, or maybe gives you anxiety, that type of working with certain types of clients like weddings and stuff like that. I can imagine that being very stressful. And it's great that that everything has come together and you feel that you're doing something that you love, that you're good at. And that is a good business. It's that Ikigai concept. And I can always get, have you come across Ikigai? So it's this kind of combination of doing something that you're good at, something that the world needs. I always get this mixed up. Something that the world needs, something that people will pay for. Anyway, it's that combination of all those. I'll remember later. I always get mixed up. But that's cool. So you mentioned the charging side of things. Now that's interesting because that's been maybe a difficulty for a lot of people. I remember when I trained as a musician and I found charging what I should be charging difficult. And it's been a real big journey to where I am now. I'm a much, much better at it now. Has that been an issue for you? The whole kind of like charging what you should be charging type thing?
Most definitely. When I was a portrait photographer, the selling element I found really uncomfortable, like really uncomfortable. And I didn't want to be pushy. And I don't think you need to be as a salesperson. I've realized that now. But I also didn't see, I don't think I saw the value in what I was doing back then. Even though people would tell me the value, you know, I went to a lot of conferences where people told their story and the reason why they were doing what they were doing. And it was really deep and heartfelt. But I didn't know. I was like, I just want to take beautiful photos. Yeah. There's no like major grand scheme behind this. I just want to take beautiful photos. And if I had all the money in the world, I would still be doing this. So the selling thing was really hard. I think, I'm not sure if this is the same for you. As soon as I became more comfortable with myself and what I could do, that's when the charging got easier.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm the best photographer in the world. I think there are people whose photography isn't as good as mine on a personal preference, but are making more money than I am because they know what to do with it. That's where I started to get comfortable. I didn't have to be the best in the world. I just need to know what I can do with my imagery and how I can help my commercial clients. And as long as they're happy, it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. You know, I'm sure there are photographers who would pick holes in my work, but I'm not trying to help them. I'm trying to help my brand clients. And as soon as that distinction got into place, I started to get more comfortable with what I was charging and recognizing that it's not just about the photo, it's not just about the photography, it's about all the elements around it.
It is, and it's about your personality and people. I mean, people are either going to love you or they're not going to like the way you work. And that can be quite difficult for people with ADHD sometimes, but I think once you said you became much more kind of content and happy in who you were. And I think working with those kind of clients who love you, all your quirks and the way you work, and they love that creativity, that is the best possible thing to do. We've all probably, I'm sure you've had worked with clients that you just don't get on. They don't like the way your brain works, and it's just horrendous. So why put yourself through all of that? That's why I think. So that's awesome to hear. Before we go back to, I wanted to kind of just finish on maybe a few more positive notes and talk about like how ADHD is maybe helping you in a way, or how that, so this is maybe the ADHD is your superpower kind of thing. We've talked about it, all the things that are maybe negative about it, but I'd like to ask you about, you know, how how ADHD is maybe affected things like relationships and things like that throughout your time. Because you mentioned you got divorced, and I know that a lot of people with ADHD really struggle with all types of relationships, whether it's with parents or friends or, you know, romantic relationships and things like that. What's been your journey with that, and how, looking back on that now, what have you maybe learnt about yourself that's helping you move forwards with things?
So it was really interesting because I was going on a bit of a journey of self-discovery before I was diagnosed or knew that I had ADHD. I was learning tactics such as, so there's a book called 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which is by a guy called Stephen Covey. It's over there. It's my Bible. And it's not an easy read. It's not a quick win, but it completely transformed a lot of the ways that I do things. And one thing in particular was having a gap between, training myself to have a gap between reaction and response. So with the emotional dysregulation side, what I used to do was react yeah, really quickly. And that book, as well as meditation, has helped me create that gap. So it's a pause where I reassess. And because I was going through that, I was being very aware of my relationship at the time. And I was being aware of what's important to me. What that helped me, what this helped me do was not be ADHD in my decision to leave my partner. I spent maybe 3 years trying to make sure that it wasn't a reaction, that it wasn't because I was getting bored, because it was a whole heap of other things. It made me very aware that of the way that my brain works, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't making a mistake. So although the ADHD didn't help me with the relationship in that respect, being aware of myself and how my brain worked, even before I knew I had ADHD, helped me make better decisions. So with ADHD, as I said, I got bored quite quickly before I knew this was happening, or similar to what you said earlier, actually, with the fear of rejection, a lot of the reasons that I decided to end relationships was either because I was bored or because in my head they were going to end it. So I got in there first because I didn't want that rejection. So it's being aware has helped me focus more on how my brain works and how it affects my relationships. And now I have a partner who I've been very open and honest with right from the very start, and I will communicate my feelings, and rather than being an emotional communication, I will be very verbal in that gap where I've created that little space between reaction and response. And so in that respect, knowing that I've got ADHD now has made it much more like coherent and how I communicate with my relationships, but it definitely helps to be self-aware. I don't know if that sounds...
No, it absolutely
has. The question.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. That is amazing that you got to that level of self-awareness, and you've learned those seem to me to be really positive strategies. Even before you knew officially that you had ADHD, you were able to put in place those positive strategies to help move forwards. And so how has, now being officially diagnosed with ADHD, how has that helped you put forward like really positive strategies? And maybe share with us like how, you know, what is the way forwards for you now? Now that you know you have ADHD, what are the things that you're putting into place? You kind of mentioned quite a kind of a holistic way forwards. Have you gone down the medication route? Tell us a little bit more about where the the next stage in your life, navigating life with ADHD?
The first thing I think I would like to say, because it's something you said earlier, is about the ADHD superpowers. That's the one thing that I didn't answer. And relationships. So one of the things that I've recognised is I am an oversharer. And that's how I gain a lot of connections. So I have no qualms about speaking quite openly about my struggles, things that make me happy, being nerdy. I'm not very good at small talk. Give me an in-depth conversation,
yeah,
and I'm away, and we're best friends. That's amazing. But I'm not very good at small talk. So the oversharing element, I now know, is apparently an ADHD thing in some people. The lack of fear, as some people have, and I will throw myself into situations because I don't mind change, and that can make a relationship as a friendship or a partner quite fun, because we're always trying new things. And I think those elements, now that I recognize them, I can almost harness them.
Yes.
So I love networking one-to-one. So that sharing, that connection, awful in a big crowd of people, absolutely terrible. But I'm leaning into that now that I know that this oversharing thing is a thing, and that it's not everybody does it, apparently. But I'm leaning into it and starting to build networks and connecting people. Even if I can't help the person with photography or a brand with photography, what I do is talk about other brands that they might, want to connect with, and being open in that sense has really helped me. Whereas some people are quite cagey, or they just talk about sales all the time. I talk about who I am, what I love, and I'm attracting the right kind of clients and people around me because I'm leaning into that openness and that oversharing, if you like. And so that's one of the superpowers that I think is gonna take me forward. And again, the other thing is, because as you said, your mind's going constantly, that creativity element has pushed me forward as well. It's like I'm always trying new things. I've tried little memberships, or I've done photography for beginners courses, which was quite successful. And having that mindset of not sticking to the same thing all the time really helps me. If something's not working, of course I will keep trying, but I'm not going to push it if there's an easier way or a different way of doing things, and I'm looking at those different ways. It's not linear. So that, again, is something that's helping me sort of push me forward and leaning into that and not being scared of the fact that everybody else who's somebody might say, no, you have to stick to this thing. But why? Being curious. One of my clients who I help with social media, she's just like, how do you keep coming up with all these ideas? Like you said earlier, because my brain doesn't stop. And whereas the negative side, whereas sometimes my brain doesn't stop in a dialogue, but once I latch onto a situation, it won't stop. There's just stuff coming at me all the time. So there's those elements which, if you can lean into the positive sides and acknowledge the negative sides, there's so many things that you can do, because you're wired differently, that are really exciting.
Oh yeah, and that's just, you just put that so beautifully. That is ultimately, at the end of the day, this podcast, I want this podcast to be educational, to help people to navigate forwards. But I don't want to sugarcoat it either. And we've not sugarcoated it today, but you've also sprinkled some hope over this as well. There is amazing things, those of us with ADHD can do amazing things. We've got this amazing kind of unquenchable, is that the right word, of curiosity. That is kind of partly our fuel. And I look back at the successes in my life, and it's always been when I've followed my curiosity, when I've followed what other people think, say I should be focused on, that's when it's just not gone so well. So I think we have to follow our curiosity, and that's beautiful. So you've definitely been implementing all of those things. And so like, so what's next for you? What in terms of your business, and in terms of your navigating forwards with ADHD, what's the next stage?
So navigating forward, sorry, you did mention I have been starting medication.
Oh yeah.
Which has been a bit of a game changer. And I was very nervous about it because I'm not somebody who is an automatic pharmaceutical taker. So, you know, I very rarely have even paracetamol if I can help it. But so far, it's been, and I was scared that it changed my brain. So far, it's been really, really positive. My energy levels, which were crashing all the time because I was mentally all over the place, have stabilized. My focus is better, but that doesn't mean that I still don't want to take a more holistic approach. So I still meditate, I still journal, you know, I'm still reading my, I don't know if you're deemed as, self-help books, but I'm always adding to what the medication can do. So I've got a solid toolkit, basically. Next for the business, worldwide domination. I've got all these grand plans and they're starting to roll. It's with the connection thing. What I would love to do is to shoot for brands abroad and you travel further afield for the shootings. At the moment, I travel all around the UK. I would love to be able to teach photographers how to become a successful commercial pet photographer, because it's quite a niche industry and it's very different from private client shoots. There are a whole heap of things. And again, because if you've got this element of ADHD in you, you've got all these ideas and you do start to hyper-focus, there are things that could just, that other people just won't think of that are accessible to you.
Yeah, and this is why entrepreneurship is such a great job, if you want to call it. Is it a job? It's a way of life. Let's put it that way. For those of us with ADHD, and it's been amazing to hear your smart strategies that you have developed over the years. And we are going to use the word smart, even though we feel uncomfortable. That's why I put it in the title, because I'm uncomfortable with it. I recoiled. yeah. I've talked about this in a video. Like, I think it's a cultural thing as well. Like, I think if you're British, it's not just the British thing. I think we don't like to put ourselves up, and we want to kind of bring ourselves down and all this kind of stuff. That's why I like to, not that all Americans are like this, but I do like spending time with my American friends, because they, it potentially rubs off a little bit of me, the more kind of, holistic view of this. But how can people find out a bit more about you and your job, and tell us about the services that you offer? Basically plug your business. You've got time to plug your business.
Okay, awesome. So as I said at the start, I am a commercial pet photographer. If you don't know what that is, then I create visual imagery to captivate your ideal audience. So it's much more than just product photography. It's telling a story, which is something that I've always loved to do. And the services that I offer is I travel all around the UK for shoots, and I take it from conception to completion with you, basically. So I will help you organize dog models or pet models, locations, the kind of shoots that you want, the kind of imagery that you want to portray your brand. And as we talked about, this creative element, I can help you come up with ideas that possibly you might not have thought about. They might be a bit ambitious also, but I'm always willing to give it a try.
That's awesome. How can people find out about you? You've got a website, and are you on socials?
Yeah, I'm on all the socials. So if you go to furandfables.com, that's my website, and all my socials are connected to there. So LinkedIn, I'm quite big on at the moment. Instagram, Facebook, little bit of TikTok, but not very much. Yeah. And X, also known as Twitter. Just type in Fur and Fables.
We always have to add that. Add that afterwards. Well, all your links will be in the show notes. So if you go to smartadhd.me and navigate to the podcast bit, and you'll find all the information there. But just before we finish, what message or advice would you say for others who are just discovering that they have ADHD, maybe in later life, later in life, maybe in their 40s or whatever? What would you say to people? What would be your message?
Learn what your strengths are. Your, as you put, ADHD superpowers. Learn how you can harness them. Read, research, you know, do some self-development work and embrace them. You know, there's possibly going to be negative sides and you can deal with those too, but you're going to get so much more confidence in yourself by learning to embrace your ADHD superpowers and harness them, and that will help with the negative side.
Thanks so much, Kerry. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on this podcast and for you to share your story. It's been a real privilege, and thank you so much for being open and honest. I know you say you're an oversharer, but it's just been beautiful. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It's been an absolute joy.